The possibility of the existence of flying saucers, we've been probing it for some weeks now, and we're going to try it again tonight. Now, of course, on hand to join me around the ufology roundtable, Bob Grove and Earl Neff, our regular panelists, and this evening, young engineering gentleman, Mr. Bob Novak. Bob, what is your interest in flying saucers? How did this come about, from an engineer to a flying saucerite?
Well, how did this come? This came about, back quite a few years. Because of this interest, actually, I started off, I went to see Major Kehoe. He had a meeting downtown once, a talk. And actually, from this talk, I received a card to go to meetings, and I started going to meetings, and from that, I just became interested and started reading books, and et cetera, by Major Kehoe and George Adamski. And from there, that's how it started. That was just it.
It's a strange prayer to mention in the same breath, I start to say. From what Earl and Bob have been telling me, George Adamski and Major Kehoe, kind of the extreme ends.
Extreme ends, right, yeah.
Well, let me set this example before yourself, Bob, and Bob Grove and Earl. Now, this is a letter that we received in the mail during the course of the week. By the way, hello, Bob.
Why, hello. How are you, Earl?
How are you?
You've seen this letter, so let me read it for our listeners now. It's a little long, but not too long. I think it deserves some attention. This came in last week to us, and it tells of an area or a theory of propulsion. So many of us are asked the question, how do you explain the fact that these flying saucers have been seen to turn at a virtual 90-degree angle? And we know, of course, by our own standards, that this is impossible. We've discussed it several times here on the UFO Roundtable. Let me read you a theory and see what you gentlemen think of it now. This comes in from... Did the person ask us not to use their name on this one early or not?
No, that's all right.
Mr. John A. Labota of Parkview, yeah. Ohio.
I don't know the gentleman, but I know it's all right.
He's got a fascinating theory here. He says, in the past few years, I've been very interested in articles and publications referring to the possibility of unidentified flying objects. Now, it's occupied my time so much that as a result of delving into these certain problems concerning the erratic movements of these flying objects, I want to at this time explain some ideas I've entertained and ask whether or not the other people, including myself, have thought along this same line. To avoid a detailed discussion, he makes it rather brief. He'll only say that the method of propulsion employed may be relative to Einstein's unified field theory and his explanation of gravitation and magnetism. The UFO, I feel, are utilizing gravitational fields of other planets or stars in their movements about our solar system and our galaxy. And based on this assumption, I'll now attempt to explain my ideas on their erratic behavior and their complete disregard for our gravitational fields. A number of articles, both by trained observers in this case, radar operators, and other competent peoples, have all stated the following similar facts. The UFOs were traveling at unheard-of speeds of thousands of miles an hour, and that while traveling a straight prescribed path, were observed to veer off this straight path as much as 90% of the prescribed path with no apparent loss of speeds, and with an amazing disregard for our laws of gravitation. This is amazing. There's no question about it. But let's stop and evaluate the preceding statement again. Speeds of thousands of miles an hour and change of direction with no apparent loss of speed. We know that our Earth has various movements with respect to its path around the sun. The two movements that we're concerned with now are its speed and rotation on its axis every 24 hours and the speed of its revolution around the sun. Well, consider that you are at this moment in a spaceship. You've attached your ship to the gravitational field of any star or even a planet in our solar system. Let's further say that, for this explanation, that you're attached to the gravitational field of Jupiter, and you've located yourself in the direct path of our planet Earth. And as you hover in space, motionless, you've calculated the Earth will pass to within 5 miles of your position. You're not moving. The Earth is approaching. Your calculations show that the Earth will pass below you at the speed of approximately 8,000 miles an hour. And as our planet passes you, an observer from our planet will look up and see you passing by at the amazing speed of 8,000 miles an hour. So as you continue to hover motionless, other observers on our planet will testify to an object traveling at fantastic speeds, yet all of this time, you've remained perfectly still. Now at this time, you, and don't forget you're in the spaceship, you decide to move from this present position and decide on a course of right angles to the direction of the path of the Earth. So you're making your first and only movement. at this precise moment, observers on Earth who have been watching you become amazed at what they see, because from their position, they testify of an object traveling at fantastic speeds and changing direction as much as 90 degrees, and they observe no loss of speed, yet you, on the spaceship, can only record one movement, and only one movement, yet the observers on Earth record two distinct movements, one of approach and one at right angles to the approach. Now imagine, therefore, how many erratic movements could be explained by this simple deduction. Well, is this, in fact, a simple deduction? Does it make any fucking sense? Bob Grove, what do you think?
This is absolutely one, and I'd like to go on record. It's definitely an approval and positive on this. I would say that this is, without any question, one of the finest bits of insight into the UFO enigma that I've ever heard written in one sheet of paper. I'd like to compliment the gentleman formally in his depth with which he has approached this thing. This is extremely fine. The unified theory, or unified field concept, as formulated by Einstein and many others now working on, is basically, as he suggests there, the various types of fields and phenomena which exist throughout the universe are actually a very close intertwining and interrelationship. And the way he has presented it, I feel, is quite marvelous. I think he's done an excellent job, and I would say without any question whatsoever, if this type of thing were observed, and if the object itself were of the size that it could be seen high above, in which case the new gravitational pull of the Earth going by would not affect the thing, and it could counteract this gravitational pull mechanically by itself, then I would say that this would very, very definitely, I think, have to be carefully considered as a possibility, yes.
Well, just from a non-expert standpoint, wouldn't it have to be way the heck up there in order to be outside of our pull and still latched on to Jupiter's pull?
Yes, as a matter of fact, it would if it is actually latched on. Now, from a standpoint, however, of it being a possibly mechanically or artificially latched on, we might say, then as the Earth goes under it, it would simply have to, by means of propulsion, simply avoid or a counterforce set up to simply repel the mutual gravitational attraction, which is a product dependent upon the masses of the two objects, the Earth and the flying object. And this could be done. This is, of course, how we basically arrive at an object going away from Earth like a rocket. We simply repel this mutual product of the two masses drawing each other together gravitationally. This thing that out or close would merely have to provide a means of propulsion to keep itself from being pulled toward the Earth, and then relatively would be remaining motionless next to Jupiter, but appear to be in quite a great velocity in its trajectory with relation to the Earth.
That's amazing. But
mm-hmm.
I think
it's a beautiful piece.
I think
beautiful
someone at this table would disagree with it.
All right.
Earl?
Yes, I do. First of all, I appreciate the great work that this man has put into this letter. I wish there were more people like him spending this kind of time to prepare a letter. I understand, although I do not know the gentleman, never have had the pleasure of meeting him, I do understand through a man who knows him quite well that he has made some changes in his thinking since he has heard some other statements made, perhaps on this program, I hope, due to the changes of color. Now, I agree with him up to a point. This would be if the object were going then just in the opposite direction. That would be fine. But as in the case of John Crawford down in Canton, Ohio, a few years back, he was telling me of this beautiful sighting that he had that where the object was swinging back and forth like a pendulum. Then you see, this is quite another picture, and the change of color due to speed and probably the closeness into our atmosphere all has direct bearing on the theory. Therefore, I do not think the man is correct in his theory, but I certainly think he has a marvelous idea there, and if he continues in this direction, he might come up with the answer, and I hope he does.
Well, I wonder about the pendulum. Couldn't that be explained simply by a continuance of this reversing? In other words, instead of going through this 90-degree one time, just to change your relative position to the Earth a number of times back and forth? Is this a...
Well, and I don't know how to answer that, but in the case of this first one that I saw that was doing the sawtooth effect, there you see you're going in three directions, one from west to east. Then, as it's going in this straight line, it is taking a 90-degree turn downward and a 45-degree turn toward the east as it continues on. This it did six times, like saw teeth. Now, that, I don't believe, could be explained by this theory.
Hmm.
What do you think, Bob?
I still feel it could.
Uh-huh.
Well, let's get into
it. Fine.
Go third voice in here, Bob Nowak. You heard it. What do you think about it, about this theory?
Well, I don't know. I tend to agree with Earl a little bit on that because, depending on how you look at it. Now, the way he stated it there, he said that, well, you could fix it on another planet. Well, actually, you'd have to fix it on something with quite a great gravitational attraction. It most probably would be the sun, if anything.
Well, there again, might we be guilty in that reasoning of using our own terms or references?
Yes.
That's
possible. But what I was trying to bring up was, as far as propulsion goes, this has been done in the laboratory, and it can be done. I might get a phone call on this, but basically this is how it works. You take a vacuum chamber, bring it up to a high degree of vacuum, and if you get the right magnets on top of the chamber and below the chamber with the right strength, you can get a metallic object to suspend itself in midair in that chamber. And this has been done before. Canada has worked on a Project Magnet before, and I imagine everybody here has heard of that, or just about. I know, I think Earl has.
Bob knows.
But,
Dr. Smith.
As far as Project Magnet goes, and I don't know if they're still working on it, but this was a Canadian effort, and they got something, I don't know the exact statistics on this, but they had something going, I believe it was not more than a few feet in the air, and it traveled around 150 feet leaps, as far as I know. Now, this was dropped because they couldn't get it to any great extent of improvement.
Oh, yeah, I remember Bob talked about that one night, yeah.
One of the things was Avro, Project Avro, which did this. The Project Magnet was basically the nomenclature for the Air Force. Well, basically, the Canadian government, the Department of Transport, had what they call their Project Magnet, which was a UFO effort by Canada. It was headed by Dr. Wilbert B. Smith from Ottawa, and that was basically UFO and had nothing to do directly with propulsion, not Project Magnet. However, the Canadian government, the Air Force, was working on this type of device, but it never got off the ground to any particular... It was too unstable in its operation.
Yeah. I know, it did get off the ground.
I've been wondering, Harv, isn't it possible some evening, perhaps we could, if we go back on a little longer schedule after the paper's off the striking situation, that we might be able to get Dr. Smith, this friend of Bob's, on the air with us, if he's,
I understand he's
able
ill
to be.
I will call him and see if he's in condition, yeah.
Right.
He has been ill.
He could contribute much.
Bob, no, I want to get into something with you in just a minute about the theories of propulsion. But right now, since some people have been waiting on the line, let's do take a couple of quick telephone questions here. What's yours, please? You've been reading about feats of water traveling on a layer of ionized air. Mm-hmm. In a what? In a hot pan. Did this have any connection with angel hair? From hot pans to ionized... Ooh. Anybody follow this?
No.
I'm
afraid I'm lost on that here.
It's traveling on a layer of what now? Ionized air. Well, didn't we discuss 1 week about the possibility of angel hair being made up of ionized air?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Maybe he's speaking of when a doctor, for instance, takes an ultrasonic instrument and puts water on it, you can see that bubbling and hopping up into the air. Is that what he's meaning?
I think perhaps what you have reference to is a new kind of boat. I know they have them in Italy, and I think they're going to have them over here, where they travel along on a layer of air.
Might be it.
What, the hydroplanes? Hydrofoils?
Hydrofoils, probably, yes.
Yeah, that's what it is.
That's a new kind of boat, and I'm waiting for them because I think they're great. Okay, thank you for calling. This is PM. Your question, please. When a UFO sighting is reported to a radio station... Mm-hmm. Go ahead. That across the country, you listen to these reports, and a sighting might come in, and radio stations will broadcast it one time, and perhaps two, but you say it's never broadcast more than one or two times. All right, so go ahead. Does someone call and tell the station not to say anything further about it? If so, who calls and what is said? Well, I can speak for myself. We've reported a number of them here on our UFO roundtable, And maybe I should feel neglected, but no one has called me. And on regular news broadcast, no, as far as I know, no one's ever called. I have heard, though. In fact, we reported a couple of them here on the roundtable discussion of radio stations. One up in, we had them on the air here. We called them up in Vermont, I believe. And according to the report, the Air Force had come in there and asked them not to report it anymore until further proof was found. I don't know where the clamping comes from, if indeed there is any clamping, and I would assume it would be a voluntary thing on the part of the radio station or the individual involved, whether to cooperate with the Air Force or not. That's a good question. Thank you for calling. Well, all right, that takes care of a couple of the questions, and we'll get to more later. But Bob Nowak, since you're here and your area of specialized interest in flying saucers in general is propulsion, let me give you about 60 seconds to prepare your own ideas as far as propulsion is concerned, because in just a minute I'll ask you that question. Speaking of space, as we do every Thursday night here on Program PM from 10:30 until 11, I don't know if you've been reading Show Magazine of late, but this particular issue, I think you, particularly those of you interested in outer space and flying saucers, will find very interesting, because they ask a question. The question is, will mankind be left behind? Will America's new space frontier create maybe a new culture? Or will it destroy the old heritages in the name of progress? Well, this current issue of Show Magazine explores these and other important aspects of man's future in space through the eyes of four very concerned authorities. Now, in Show, noted critic Max Lerner looks to a great rebirth in our arts, sciences, and politics. General James Gavin draws upon his experience and examines the byproducts of space explorations and their impact on our daily lives. Theologian scholar C.S. Lewis asks some disturbing questions about the spiritual problems to be encountered. And then science expert Edwin Diamond reports on Telstar's growing role in shaping our future progress. A very good issue this week for Show Magazine, especially for people interested in outer space. They say, and I quote this, events and discoveries can reshape our thinking as well as our machines, our cultures, as well as our wars. And if you don't think so, they suggest that you stick around and watch your TV set about 1965, maybe. Don't miss Max Lerner, James Gavin, C.S. Lewis, and Ed Diamond in the February issue of Show Magazine. It's on sale right now. 12 minutes before 11 o'clock, and on the Program PM UFO Roundtable this evening, Bob Grove and Earl Neff, and a special guest this evening, Bob Nowak. Bob, what have you determined in your own mind is behind the propulsion of flying saucers, if they exist?
Well, if they exist, then we'll put that qualifative. It all depends on one thing. Now, we're talking about magnetic fields. First of all, I'd like to say one thing, that when this gentleman wrote this letter about the 90-degree turns, you could explain it simply as this, as far as why they'll people say, why can these people inside these spaceships, how can they take this force? But if you consider this fact, like I explained to Bob once, that everything is relative to the people in the ship. Just like we are on Earth, and I don't know if you ever stopped to consider this, but we are on Earth traveling through around the sun at approximately 8,000 miles an hour. Our solar system is traveling through space in the Milky Way at approximately 1 million miles an hour.
In other words, as I'm sitting here before the microphone right now, I am jolly well not sitting still.
Right. In fact, if you stop to consider it, you could actually be in motion in seven different ways at the same time. The first motion, you're going around the solar system or around the sun at 8,000 miles an hour. That's number one. Number two, the Earth and the whole solar system are traveling in the Milky Way at approximately a million miles an hour. That's three. The third one is the whole galaxy itself is traveling through space. Fantastic. It's way up 10 to the who knows what miles an hour, 10 to the who knows what power. It's way up there. And then if you consider that, say you're on Earth, while this is all going on, we already have three motions. You're on a train going in one direction, going up a hill. That's five. And going up a hill, that's six, because you're a train going in a direction, and then you're going up a hill, that's six. And you're walking backward down the corridor of the train. That's seven different motions at the same time.
I think you sneaked an extra one in there, but I'll give you the benefit of the doubt.
But anyway, everything is relative. Actually, like I say, you're on Earth, you don't feel the motion. with all this great speed that we're actually
out of the supply of existence,
not to a UFO, to the people in the flying saucer, whoever controls it, everything is relative to them. In other words, as we are relative to the Earth, they are relative to the flying saucer. As that flying saucer makes a 90-degree turn, it doesn't affect them just as well as we're not affected by us traveling through space at the great rate that we are. I don't know if this can be easily seen, but if you stop and think about it, it's true. You can consider the flying saucer as its own little Earth with its own gravitational field, and it's traveling through space. All of a sudden, it makes a sharp turn. Well, everybody inside
that ship... Let me interrupt a second. Could it be like, for example, you've seen these little balloons that they sell to children. It'll be a balloon inside of a balloon. Inside of that balloon, they'll have a little picture of Mickey Mouse, maybe. Is this like the Mickey Mouse inside that balloon would be like the spaceship inside this gravitational field that it's creating?
Right, right. You could look at it that way. Basically, that's it. As you are to the Earth, somebody is to this ship.
What creates this gravitational field?
Well, as far as this creation of the gravitational field, it could be one of many things. Now, one possible theory was, and this is proposed by a few scientists, I've read this before, that like that principle that I told you, that you could take a vacuum chamber, and it's possible, this has been done in a laboratory, you have two huge magnets with a terrific coulombs of energy passing through them, you have a little metal object in there, and it will suspend itself in midair. Now, if this was applied in reverse onto the ship itself, it could be deflecting the Earth's magnetic attraction. Now, one thing that's more or less possible proof of why these ships work on magnetic attraction, and it would be specifically of the Earth and not another planet, is this, that I don't know if you noticed or not, but the recent reports on any flying saucers around this area, most of them will be in Akron. There's a reason for this, because near Akron, or well, not far away from Akron anyway, I don't know the exact mileage, but a geophysicist or somebody on that line could probably tell you that there is a magnetic fault running through the Earth at pretty close to Akron, or in that area anyway. And magnetic faults are lines of specific intensity, a little bit greater intensity than other places. In other words, latitude or longitude running from the north to the south?
Longitude.
Well, you could consider those like the longitudinal lines. Mm-hmm. They're not really. But they run from north to south. And
like
as you pass to this point, or to this line, you are going to a point of greater magnetic attraction. And this has been picked up by satellites recently, and it's data. And you go to one magnetic, you can see by instrumentation, you have a greater magnetic attraction as you approach this line. As you go away from it, it fades out. You go to the next line, it comes in again. It increases.
Well, actually, this whole thing of creating its own gravitational field around it may seem completely far-fetched and everything, because this is like a mode of transportation carrying its own mode of transportation. But yet, there was the day when everything was done by oneself, transportation was done by something living, an animal of some kind, when it looked completely ridiculous to ever think of a machine that would actually move without a human being pulling it. An automobile. Ridiculous. Well, let's see if we can get a couple more questions here now from listeners who are calling in. What's your question, please? You have in front of you a book, and it relates to our discussion a moment ago about the censorship of the Air Force. Go ahead. And you'd like to ask Mr. Nowak this question, right? The book was written by Edward Ruppel, the former head of the what?
Mm.
Of the Air Force Project on Flying Saucers. Mm-hmm. You say you feel the Air Force has clamped down quite a bit on the information about flying saucers. All right, go ahead, sir. Why is this book allowed? Well, what does the book say? Let me ask you that first. I mean, the book is entitled The Report on Unidentified Flying Object. Well, does it just say that, in essence, take 300 pages to say they don't exist? It takes 300 pages to tell what the Air Force has done. Are you familiar with this book, Bob? Is anybody familiar with it?
Yes.
I've glanced through it. I haven't read it thoroughly, though. No.
Bob, have you read through it?
Okay. Yes, that's one of the latest I read.
What does it say, basically?
Well, basically, the idea, the format of the book, almost in its entirety, approximately 98% of the book, I'd say, builds up the Air Force investigation of UFO through the entire history of UFO as actually observed by the Air Force formally. And then this was his first book. He, by the way, was head of the Project Blue Book. He has now passed away about 3 or 4 years ago, right?
That's right.
And the interesting part about it, in his first edition, he merely presents all the facts concerning what the UFO investigation, the fruit it has borne, without coming to conclusions, and says and leads the reader to believe all through it that definitely something must be there. It's very interesting, the information he's presented. Then another edition, which is called the Brand New Enlarged Edition, in which he has placed, this was just about a year after this was out, he has placed in it a final chapter in which people say, he starts out by saying, people often ask me if I personally believe in flying saucers. Positively, I don't.
Do you remember, Harv, it was only a few weeks back, I think it was the week that Bob was home snowbound, that I quoted Captain Ed Ruppelt in the 6 letters that he had written to Major Kehoe, and in there stating how he had wanted to let information out and was being clamped down on. Do you recall that?
Yes, I do, but he is now out, right, of
the
Air Force?
He's dead.
Well,
he's out of the Air Force.
When he wrote this book, he's in a different one now. Mm-hmm. When he wrote this book, was he out of the Air Force? And if so,
yes.
Would he not be out
yes.
from under this ruling?
No.
He would not be?
No.
He wouldn't be out from under the ruling, but he was no longer in the Air Force. He still retained, though, his title, didn't he, Captain?
Well, I guess the question why was he allowed to even write this book, as little as it said?
Well, that last book was a retraction, practically, with that chapter, you see.
I see. Okay, thank you for calling. Very good question. This is PM. One quick question, please. All right, go ahead. What about the possible use of iron plasma as a source of propulsion? Possible?
Possible.
Yes, iron and some of the other dense materials yielding a high ion concentration. Iron, lithium, cadmium. Yeah, there are a number of these that can do that. It's a possibility, iron. Mm-hmm.
No one has checked it out to find if...
As far as a possible propulsion system, it is definitely possible, and it is proven, and the NESA is presently working on such material. In fact, they have an atomic powered generation type of ion propulsion. They have a small atomic pile, basically, real quickly. It's a small atomic pile. It produces steam to drive a turbine, which drives an electric generator, which produces your ions. Now, this is through a complicated process, and we don't have time to do it right now to explain it. But, like I say, it is possible. I've read into this extensively, and I know the theory behind it, and it does work. I mean, they have it proven, definitely. And they are going to use this on long-distance trips, for instance, like to Mars. The only thing they're running into problems with is cooling the atomic reactor. Out in space, cooling is a difficult problem. They need a radiator about the size of a football field to cool off things. And the problem they run into here is that meteorites, because of such a size of radiator, can penetrate. And they're trying to find a material that is light enough and yet able to withstand this meteoric punctures.
The amazing world we're living in. So, we could just project our... Thank you very much for calling. I was just projecting my mind back as you were talking, just to the end of the last century, you know, when things like automobiles were just coming along. And
this has been
60 years.
Pardon me.
Yes, sir.
I was just going to say, we never got around to thanking all these people who have written this week. Ms. Walter Phil and Quentin Seeley and William Deal and...
I'll tell you, next week maybe we'll take a special little extra time and answer a bunch of these letters that have been coming in. And don't forget a reminder also to you that the UFO Report Center, people are always asking, where should I report if I see anything resembling an unidentified flying object? The number is 234-0861 for the UFO Report Center, 234-0861. Now, speaking of outer space, or at least up there in the air somewhere, here's something that I think sort of pertains, because it's definitely up there in the air. Fly to Bob Nowak, who joined us this evening and will be back again at a future date, and also Earl Knapp and Bob Grove. Next week, Earl just reminds me with a little note here, Lawrence Blasey will be on. He is the Cleveland UFO Society. Is that it?
That's
Earl?
Right.
And he represents them. He'll be on hand here with a completely different viewpoint of flying saucers. Yes, ma'am.
And next week, I'd like to make a comment on a couple of letters from the Air Force that I talked to Bob Groves about. I'm having a difficult time, a very difficult time getting a hold of them, but I intend to, and we'll talk about that next week.
Well, we're having a hard time squeezing some time out of here. That's it for tonight on Program PM. Final reminder that, let's see, yes, Bob and Earl will stick around tonight to answer some questions.
Answer calls as they come in, right?
241-5637. If you'd like to keep calling, we'll answer the calls even after we go off the air. 241-5637. That's it for tonight on Program PM.